These are Records with Reed. Ralph Flanagan's Penthouse Serenade welcomes another hour of the great music of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and today a very special guest. From the Liberty Broadcasting System studios, Tom Reed with this great music. And, you know, you have been so kind in your emails and comments about the program, and one of the things that you told me is you really enjoy when we focus in on a particular guest and we play their music and talk to them about their career. So today we have Frankie Randall, who often co-hosts the program with me, and we're going to talk about Frankie's career and play his music. So it's a featured artist day on Records with Reed. Well, Frankie, as I recall, you started playing the piano at a very early age.
7, to be exact.
Wow.
Yes.
Did you come from a musical family?
My father was a trumpet player, and all of his brothers were excellent singers, and they played instruments as well. But I guess you'd say I came from a musical family. And actually, my influence to start playing piano was from a cousin of my dad's by the name of Jack Fina. And Jack Fina was a wonderful piano player who worked with the Freddie Martin Orchestra years ago.
I remember that name.
Yeah, Jack Fina. He wrote Bumble Boogie.
That's it.
Yeah, the Flight of the Bumblebee, but in a boogie style. And it was very, very well received and became very popular there for a while.
How did he influence your playing the piano?
I graduated Clifton High School in Clifton, New Jersey, and so did Jack, of course, many years earlier. And while he and Freddie Martin were working at, I believe, the Waldorf Astoria in New York, he came back to Clifton High School, to his alma mater, and decided to do a concert for the high school. So my dad took me out of, I was in grade school at the time, of course, 7 years old, and he had me excused early and took me over to the high school to watch this concert. And after watching Jack and just fascinated by his piano playing, but moreover by the response that he got after his performance, which where he had people running up to him and asking for his autographs and all these pretty little girls around him, and I was just so impressed by the reaction that he received that I said to my father on the way home, you know, Dad, I think I want to be a piano player.
Really?
So my dad went out and bought me a piano player, actually, that had been in his family. He tracked it down and bought it. I think he paid $10 or $15 for the piano, and it was an old upright. It was a very, you know, very good upright. It was still in excellent shape. And he said, if you learn to play the piano, he says, I'll buy you a baby grand. And years later, he did buy me a baby grand piano. And that was really the beginning of it all. And then as a young man, Tom, I had rheumatic fever. It left me with a murmur in my heart, which I don't have anymore. That a murmur kind of comes and goes. And but I couldn't go out and play football with the kids and ride my bicycle and do the things that kids customarily do after school. So I played the piano, and every day after school I'd come home and practice for an hour or two, and got very interested in it. And then around the age of 13, I started with classical music. My dad took me to an old school chum and music friend of his by the name of Marion Baldino, a wonderful woman. And I'd walk in for my weekly piano lesson, and she'd say, well, here comes the genius, you know. And
that's great.
She was a wonderful teacher. She was very, very tough. She expected an awful lot. When she gave me a lesson, she expected the following week that I would come back and have it perfected. So she was a great influence on me, and I learned to play Hanin and Czerny and Rachmaninoff and all those wonderful books that she used to give me to learn to play these concert pieces with. And then my attention went to jazz, and I began to listen to people like Oscar Peterson and Andre Previn and all these wonderful piano players. So that's when I decided I wanted to be a jazz piano player.
I'm going to ask you about when you did your first professional gig and when you decided you wanted to sing as well as play the piano. But let's listen to a song that I've heard you use as a show opener many times. It's called A Wonderful Day Like Today.
On a wonderful day like today, I defy any cloud to appear in the sky. Dare any raindrop to plop in my eye. On a wonderful day like today, on a wonderful morning like this, when the sun is as big as a yellow balloon, even the sparrows are singing in tune. On a wonderful morning like this, on a morning like this, I could kiss everybody. I'm full of love and goodwill. Let me say furthermore, I'd adore everybody to come and dine. A pleasure's all mine and I will pay the bill. May I take this occasion to say that the whole human race should go down on its knees, show that we're grateful for mornings like these, for the world's in a wonderful way, on a wonderful day like today. On a wonderful day like today, I defy any cloud to appear in the sky. Dare any raindrop to plop in my eye. On a wonderful day like today, on a wonderful morning like this, when the sun is as big as a yellow balloon, even the sparrows are singing in tune. On a wonderful morning like this, on a morning like this, I could kiss everybody. I'm full of love and goodwill. Let me say furthermore, I'd adore everybody to come and dine. The pleasure's all mine, and I will pay the bill. May I take this occasion to say that the whole human race should get down on its knees, show that we're grateful for mornings like these, for the world's in a wonderful way, on a wonderful day.
Boy, what a great show opener, Frankie.
It really is a great show opener. And, you know, you'll notice that that particular version is 1 minute and 59 seconds. The aim there was, in those days, we tried to keep songs under 3 minutes or around 3 minutes, certainly under 4 minutes. And we found that so many radio announcers were looking for something to fill at the end of a show or at the beginning of the show that would be under 2 minutes. So we aimed it that way, and by God, it got all kinds of airplay. Of course, the song is from Leslie Bricus and Anthony Newley's Broadway play, The Roar of the Grease Paint and Smell of the Crowd. And the song was recorded by so many people. It was part of a group of songs that really were wonderful. That face, that marvelous face.
Oh, yes.
Shirley Bassey did, and The Joker, and Barbara Streisand recorded Look at That Face. Sammy Davis, of course, recorded Feeling Good and all those. There were so many great songs in it. I'm trying to think of some of the other songs that were in Roar of the Grease Paint. Oh, Who Can I Turn To? A big hit for Sammy Davis Jr. And it was on Broadway in 1965. And so we picked that song to hopefully get lots of airplay. And we're still getting it, Tom. Thank you to you.
Well, and I remember the last time I saw you perform in Las Vegas, you used that as your opening song, and you actually came in through the audience rather than starting out on stage.
Yes, I like doing that. I like walking through the audience from the back of the room and shaking hands with a few people. You know, I find that with an audience, if you touch one person in that audience, it seems like you touch them all.
Yeah.
And they all kind of feel familiar with you. So I walk through the back of the room and come down through the aisles and eventually make my way on stage. And I do that with another song, hopefully we'll do this afternoon, which was written by a good friend of mine who is unfortunately not with us anymore, but that's Cy Coleman and Carolyn Lee, and we'll let you get to that one in a little bit.
Okay. Well, now, picking up the story, you're playing the piano. You started out learning classical and then enjoyed jazz. When did you stop and say to your dad, hey, you know, I think maybe I'll do this as a profession. I mean, this is sort of fun, and it's something I can do rather than sports because, as you mentioned, the health problem. But when did you decide this is going to be a living?
I think it was the encounter with Jack Fina, actually. I said, you know, what a life this could be where people admire you and they treat you real nice. So I think at a young age I decided to do it. Of course, my dad used to always say to me, well, you can do this for a while, but then eventually I want you to get a real job.
Yeah, that's like my young worker on radio stations. I think my dad always thought, you know, you're going to be a doctor, go stand for medical school like I did. I mean, this is better than pumping gas at a young age, but this isn't a real life.
Dad, having been a part-time musician, quite honestly, his musical talents playing trumpet was instrumental in getting my mom and dad through the Depression. My dad would go out and work for $2 a night or $3 a night, and that additional income was very helpful to them getting by.
Sure.
So he always looked at it as a kind of a thing that you do on the side, but
right.
You always had a real job. And there's a cute little story, if you got time for it right now.
Sure.
The first time I worked the Copacabana in New York, now mind you, I'd been playing all the little jazz clubs in and around New York City and northern New Jersey and Atlantic City and all those shore points in New Jersey. And I was making a pretty decent living. I was going to college at the time. And then I signed with RCA after working at Gilly's. Some of the big executives from RCA were lured into Gilly's by a gentleman who was a manager of mine by the name of Lenny Poncher. And they heard me sing, and they said, why don't we do an album with him, but instead of playing piano, why don't we have him be a stand-up singer? Because at the time, it was Frankie Avalon and Bobby Darin and Bobby Rydell, and all the singers were stand-up singers, including one of my favorites, and that was Nat King Cole. Nat King Cole was a wonderful piano player, but then became a stand-up singer as well. And I had some great conversations with Nat when I was working in Florida. I was at the Eden Rock at a place called Harry's American Bar. Nat King Cole was next door at the Fontainebleau working with a huge orchestra, and I had a trio working with me at Harry's American Bar. And I felt very uncomfortable because for years I had been so happy playing piano and singing, and it's your hands are occupied, you're behind this huge instrument. And when I had to stand up and sing, I was very uncomfortable in terms of my presentation, how to stand, what to do with my hands, and where to walk, and all that kind of uncomfortable stuff to think about while you're trying to sing a song. And I remember Nat King Cole telling me that no matter how large the orchestra was, he was working with something like 40 musicians next door, and he said, no matter how big the orchestra is, I still feel most comfortable when I'm at the piano. And quite honestly, there are times that I feel more comfortable sitting at the piano, even though I have a big band on stage, but I've gotten very comfortable by the same token working in front of a big band.
Tell us, you mentioned about Gilly's. Tell us, how did you get the job at Gilly's, and how did that lead to your friendship with Frank Sinatra?
At a club in New York had the World's Fair at the time, and I was working in the World's Fair area where all this celebration was taking place. And Gilly came in with the fellow who was the manager of the place, a man by the name of Mike Patrick. and an agent by the name of Tony Nino. And the three of them came in, they sat down and called me over to the table when I finished. And at the time, Peter Nero had been working at Gilly's, and he was leaving because he had signed with RCA. So they had to fill that spot. And up until that point, they always were had duos play there, a piano player and a bass player. And I told Gilly that I wanted to work there. I'd love to work there because at the time, Gilly's was the hot spot in New York. And so I said, but I want to use a trio. He said, no, we can't use trios. He says, the drums, it's too noisy. The place is too small. I said, Gilly, just let me try it. Let me try it for a couple of weeks. And I stayed there for so long. And then from that point on, that's all they used was trios. But it was a fascinating place. It was right in the theater district, right next to the Alvin Theater. And at the time, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off was working next door. And the theater people would stop in after the theater. And then the late night crowd, the after dinner crowd that went to Danny Stradella's Hideaway and Copacabana and all those places, they would all stop by. And it was open until 4 o'clock in the morning on weekends and 2 o'clock in the morning during the week. And from 12 until 2 or 3, that place was just jammed. They used to have to put all the lights up to get the people out. It was a fascinating place.
And how did you come in contact with Frank Sinatra there?
That's where I met him, at Gilly's. I met Frank one night. I was there only about maybe 2 weeks, 10 days, 2 weeks, somewhere in there. And the room always had a certain amount of, when I say noise in it, not that it was a noisy club, because people did come in to hear either me, or there was a fellow who I worked opposite for the most part by the name of Bobby Cole. And he was a very talented guy, singer, piano player. And they would primarily come in to listen to the music, but there's always that little undertone of some sort of crowd noise. Well, this one night, it became so quiet, and in walked Frank Sinatra with about eight or so guys around him. And he walked by the piano, he stopped for a second, and he gave me one of those, you know, where you put your index finger and your thumb together, you know, that perfect sign, you know, and he winked at me and went to a back table and sat down. At the end of the night, I met Frank Sinatra. Gilly brought me over and introduced me to him, and I sat down and spent some time with him, and it was just fascinating. I couldn't believe that I was sitting at a table with Frank Sinatra, because the first part of when he came in, the first part of the evening, or his visit, I should say, I stopped singing. I just played instrumental songs, and Gilly came over to me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm so uncomfortable singing while that guy is sitting back there." He said, "You sing. This guy's going to love you." And so he complimented me, and we locked the doors, and Gilly went back to the kitchen and started cooking some breakfast kind of food, like peppers and eggs and sausage and whatever else. And while we were waiting for Gilly, Frank says to me, "Let's go back to the piano." So we went back to the piano. He sat down next to me, and he said, "Let's do a song while we're waiting." And I said, "What do you want to do?" He says, "Well, how about Where or When?" And I said, "What key do you want it in?" He said, "What key do you sing it in?" I said, "Well, I sing it in E-flat." So he said, "Well, just let's do it in E-flat." And he started singing, and then I would sing four bars, and he would sing four bars, and we went back and forth. And it's like it was yesterday, Tom. It was kind of an electrifying feeling. Something that I'll always remember. It was just wonderful. It was fascinating to me.
And then you became very good friends with Frank.
Yes, as a result of that, I became very dear friends with him, and he was very helpful in the beginnings of my career. The first big stage I worked in Las Vegas was through Frank Sinatra. He arranged it that I opened for Joey Bishop at the Sands Hotel, and he was just very helpful. Anybody who he cared for, he would try to help in any way possible that he could.
Let's listen to that song. Where or When?
talked like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or when. The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. The smile you're smiling, you were smiling then, but I can't remember where or when. Some things that happen for the first time seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we've met before, and we laughed before, and loved before. But who knows, who knows where or when. Some things that happen, happen for the first time, seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we've met before, and we laughed before, and we loved once before. But who knows, who knows where, where or when.
Well, in a sense, Frankie, that was your first duet with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. Great song written by Cole Porter in 1937. Oh, no, that was written by Rodgers and Hart, I'm sorry. That's from Babes in Arms and, yes, Where or When. Great arrangement, too, Tom. That's Frank Sinatra's arrangement. I was fortunate enough a couple of years before Mr. Sinatra died. I asked if I could use some of his arrangements, and he sent me, as a wonderful gift, he sent me a whole group of arrangements. In fact, that whole album of Frankie Randall right now is with the use of Frank Sinatra's arrangements. And what a thrill it was to sing to those arrangements. I remember when I was working for Steve Wynn. I went to work for Steve Wynn actually in a lounge in Atlantic City. And soon became not only a friend of Steve's, but entertainment coordinator and then entertainment director. And ultimately, when he sold it to Bally's, I became vice president of entertainment. And it was so wonderful to be able to spend not my own money, of course, but millions of dollars on behalf of the Golden Nugget and on behalf of Bally's for Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis and just the best, most powerful entertainers of that era. And
So Frankie, you put your own career aside and went into the business aspect of the industry.
I totally enjoyed it, Tom. It was as gratifying and rewarding as performing, to be able to have these entertainers work there and have the hotel and the property do so well, the casino, just the action, the visibility that having performers like this raise to a property is staggering. And of course they still use that concept today in Las Vegas and elsewhere, bringing high powered entertainment in and having them generate the business that they do. So but it was wonderful. We had the finest lineup of entertainment in those years in the Golden Nugget in the 80s that you could ever imagine in every field, not only the pop field like the Sammys and the Dean Martins and Frank Sinatras, but also in the country field with Willie Nelson and Kenny Rogers, Chris Christopherson, just wonderful entertainment of all types. Then we had a large arena that was erected across the way from the hotel. It was an outdoor, almost a pavilion kind of a situation, sat 4,000 people. Then we played every concert act there was, like Crosby, Stills and Nash and Ringo Starr and Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind and Fire, all the big concert acts that were touring the country. So it was fascinating. It really was.
Well, and you actually hired Frank Sinatra.
That line reminds me of I did Merv Griffin's show, because Merv was, first of all, a very big fan of mine, just like I was of his, and I used to do his show all the time. And so Merv decided he wanted to do a week's worth of shows at the Golden Nugget. So he said to me, did you ever think that when we used to come and see you at Jilly's that it would wind up this way? And I said, you know, Merv, no, I just never saw this in my future. He said, do you mean you tell Frank Sinatra when to sing? And and I turned away from the camera and my eyes went up. I said, well, you know, I mean, in other words, you only have a certain amount of power. You really can't tell these people what to do because of the stature that they hold. So, but it was fun. It was fun to interact with them. The best part about it is that what it produced in terms of success for the properties was incredible.
Well, didn't you come up with the idea, Frankie, to have Frank Sinatra as sort of the spokesman for Steve Wynn? I remember commercials that he did.
He did a couple of commercials with Steve. What that was part of, yes, you're right. What that was part of was Frank Sinatra at that time was working, I believe he was working at the Desert Inn or the Sands in Las Vegas, and in Atlantic City, he was working for Resorts International. And when I first started working for Steve as an executive, it was as an entertainment director, and the only thing I had to book were the lounges, because we had an ongoing show in the showroom that was just a very pleasing kind of a show, a wonderful production, and it was called The Follies. In fact, The Follies in Palm Springs, you're a frequent visitor of Palm Springs, you know what The Follies is like here. Well, that concept is a little different than what The Follies was that was working at the Nugget, but it was the same concept of a bunch of flag-waving songs, and they would gear the production like The Follies on Broadway, The Boardwalk Follies, different kinds of follies they would focus on. The one here, of course, is the same type of show, but they focus on the fact that these people are 55 plus. And it's a wonderful show, which I know you've seen so many times, and
sure,
so have I. But we had this Follies show in the showroom, and it was not really an expensive show. And one day, I was with Steve Wynn at his home in Sun Valley. And he said, you know, the loungers are doing so well, because at the time I was scheduling people like Keeley Smith and Billy Daniels and Billy Eckstein and all these wonderful showroom acts, but I was scheduling them in the lounges. And we did very, very, very well as far as business was concerned and visibility, and we really increased our business. So anyway, at Steve's home, he says to me, I want you to take our entertainment policy right to the top. I want you to get all your friends, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, and he's rattling all these names on and on and on. I said, Steve, it's a staggering amount of money that you're talking about right now. He says, I don't care. I want to take this hotel, the Golden Nugget, and I want to put this hotel on the map. At the time, there were 9 hotels in the city of Atlantic City, and we were ranked 7th. And a part of it had to do with the fact that the Golden Nugget was the southernmost hotel on the boardwalk. It was down near Ventnor. The other hotels like Caesars and Bally's and the Claridge, they were, as soon as you got off the expressway, you were right in the heart of town where these other hotels were. And the traffic in that area, not only the automobile traffic, but the traffic on the boardwalk was staggering. I mean, it was just, that's where all the people congregated. But at the Golden Nugget, again, which was southernmost, there was not that much traffic. So we needed to get the people down to that end. We needed to give them a reason to want to go all the way down to the Golden Nugget. So I said, you know, it's a great idea, Steve, but it's going to be certainly expensive. He says, I don't care. So he says, well, where do you suggest we start? I said, let's start with Frank Sinatra. So he says, well, get him. I said, well, it's not that easy. I said, he gets comfortable in a hotel. He knows the back hallways. He knows the suite he's going to be in. He's comfortable coming in. It's tough to break him away from that. I said, for us to break him away, we're going to have to offer him something that's going to really open his eyes. And I went to Frank's, I put an agreement together. And part of it was that he would be a spokesperson for the Golden Nugget, i.e. doing commercials for us and saying the Golden Nugget was the best casino and so on. And the reasoning behind that is wherever Frank Sinatra had ever worked, that seemed to be the in spot, whether it was the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas or Caesar's Palace or Desert Inn, wherever he decided he wanted to work, that's where every major performer wanted to work. They always looked at Frank Sinatra as the guy who almost set the precedent for the finest hotel or the finest property or the most fun property. So I went to New York at the time. Sinatra used to keep an apartment at the Waldorf Astoria up there. And I called his secretary, who I just spoke to not very long ago, Dorothy Ullman, a wonderful lady. She's living in Las Vegas now. Anyway, I said, Dottie, I want to come up and meet with Mr. S. She says, anytime you want. So I picked a day, went up there, met with him, waited for him to get up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he came out, and he said, how you doing? I said, I'm doing fantastic. He said, I understand you're going to have a great job. I said, yes, I'm working in Atlantic City for a great guy by the name of Steve Wynn. Treats me great, loves music, and so much wants you to perform there. He says, well, you know, I'm so comfortable at resorts, and you know the way I feel. I said, I do, Frank. I said, I'm going to cut right to the center of this deal. I says, I'm here to offer you $10 million.
Whoa.
He said, sit down. He says, let's talk about this.
Bring on the coffee.
Yeah, he sat down and we talked about it. And I said, one of the provisions, I said, I would like to see you represent the hotel and do some commercials with Steve Wynn. And the remainder will be for performances that will spread between Las Vegas and Atlantic City. And we outlined it. Sitting in the room was Jilly and a gentleman by the name of Sonny Golden, who was Frank Sinatra's accountant at the time. We hammered a deal out, and that was the beginning of a wonderful friendship and a very, very successful campaign.
I want you to tell me the Sammy Davis golf course story after we listen to So In Love.
Okay, great.
Strange dear, but true dear, when I'm close to you, dear, the stars fill the sky, so in love with you am I. Even
without you. My arms fold about you. You know, darling, why so in love with you am I? In love with a night mysterious, the night when you first were there. In love with a joy delirious, when I knew that you could care. So taunt me and hurt me, deceive me, desert me. I'm yours till I die. So in love, so in love, so in love with you, my love, am I. When you first were there. In love with a joy delirious, when I knew that you could care. So taunt me and hurt me, deceive me, desert me. I'm yours till I die. So in love, so in love, so in love with you, my love.
What a great song, Frankie.
Cole Porter. The other day I watched DeLovely. It's the life of Cole Porter, and he wrote so many, many great songs. In fact, not long ago, I was working at Feinstein's in New York, and we went over to the Waldorf Astoria just to kind of walk through, and there's a piano on the second level that was Cole Porter's piano, and I sat down at it and took some pictures, of course, and it was such a thrill to sit at a piano where so many songs came out of. But Cole Porter, what a fascinating life he lived, and so many songs that he wrote that are just wonderful, wonderful songs.
Well, tell me about the story. You got Frank Sinatra to work for you. What about Sammy Davis Jr.?
Sammy Davis was another one of those loyal people that once he worked for somebody who treated him great, and God knows that Bill Hara had a reputation of treating performers great. Yes, if you worked at Harrah's at Lake Tahoe, for example, he gave you a home while you worked there, right on the lake, on Lake Tahoe. And Bill Harrah was an automobile collector as well, so he gave you the choice of a Rolls Royce to drive around while you were there. He pampered you.
And he had a big yacht.
Oh, yeah.
I was out on that with Lawrence Welk.
Really? Yeah, he really knew how to pamper performers, and he had this feeling toward performers, this empathy or whatever the word might be. And so Sammy had worked for Bill Hara for so many years, and of course Bill Hara passed away, and but Sammy still continued to work for Bill Hara. So I knew that he had this, like I say, this allegiance to somebody who had treated him so nicely. So one day I called him. He was working at Harrah's in Atlantic City, and I, of course, was at the Golden Nugget. And I called him and said, "Sam, let's go out and hit a couple golf balls." So part of my agreement was that I had a membership at Atlantic City Country Club. I said, "I'll pick you up. We'll go play at Atlantic City." He said, "Fine." So we got to the second, third hole, and I'm thinking, well, when am I going to hit him with this? So he hit a great shot. And I said, "Wow, Sam, great shot." I said, "Listen, I want to talk to you about something." I said, "You know, I'm working at the Nugget, and I'm the entertainment director there. And we have Frank working for us. We have Dean Martin working for us. The capper would be if you'd join this roster of stars that we have." He said, "Frankie, you know, Bill Hara," I said, "I know, I know. He was great to all of us, and and I respect that. But we'd love to have you there. And I says, I'll cut right to the center of this deal. I said, let's talk dollars and cents. I said, I know that they're providing a huge orchestra for you at Harrah's and all the perks in the room, food and beverage and all that good stuff. I'm here to offer you $50,000 a show versus the $15,000 that they're paying you. So he said, okay, that's the deal. Let's do it. See, that's what, and I hate to place it on money, but it, in so many cases, life does come down to you know, you take your best shot, and your best shot usually has to do with the amount of money you earn.
Well, you know, Frankie, it's sort of like the athletes. You only have so many good years, and mm-hmm. so you've got to make the money while you can.
That's a great analogy, and the entertainment business is that way. Although, I picked up the newspaper yesterday and see where K-Star just worked here in Palm Springs. She's 87 years old.
Isn't that great?
It's wonderful. So, and our dear friend, who just moved back to the desert, was living up on the mountain for a long while, Herb Jeffries, who's 96. And I did a show at the McCallum Theater this past February, and I had all my friends stop in. Peter Marshall and Hal Linden, Carol Channing came in and sang, and Herb Jeffries as well, Keeley Smith. Keeley Smith is well into her 80s. She's still out there singing. So so many performers these days. Well, I talked about Billy Daniels earlier. He was in his 70s and early 80s when he was working for us in Atlantic City. So it's good to see how performers, and God knows I'm getting older, and I'm still performing, and I love doing it. It's a wonderful feeling to get out on a stage and have people applaud for you and smile at you and treat you wonderfully, and you still do something that you love to do.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. After we hear one of my favorite songs by Frankie Randall, I'm going to ask you about how you came up with this fabulous show idea, That's Italian. I Remember You, Frankie Randall.
Was it in Tahiti? Were we on the Nile? Long, long ago, say an hour or so, I recall I saw you smile. I remember you, you're the one who made my dreams come true a few kisses ago. And I remember you, you're the one who said I love you true. I do, didn't you know? I remember too a distant bell and stars that fell like rain out of the blue. When my life is through and the angels ask me to recall the thrill of them all, then I will tell them I remember you. Distant bell and stars that fell like rain out of the blue. So
when my life is through and the angels ask me to recall the thrill of them all, then I will tell them I remember, tell them I remember, tell them I remember
you. You know, that's one of the songs that I think you do in That's Italian.
I do. It's a great song written by Johnny Mercer and Victor Schertzinger, 1941. And it's from an old movie that they did in 1942 with Dorothy L'Amour and Bob Everly, Helen O'Connell, Jimmy Dorsey in the orchestra. It's a great song that everybody from Judy Garland to Jerry Southern, Four Freshmen, June Christie, Dinah Washington, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, everybody recorded that song. And, of course, more recently, people like Diana Krall. Wonderful, wonderful song written by Johnny Mercer. And you and I watched that Johnny Mercer special that they had on PBS. It was I never realized he wrote so many songs, including one of my favorites, which is Laura, of course.
Yeah. But, oh, that's because you have a daughter by the name of Laura.
Yes, I do. I do. In fact, she lives in San Francisco. And I spoke to Dean Martin's daughter yesterday, Dina Martin, and it kind of leads into what you asked me for a little earlier in the show. I do a show called That's Italian, and based on availability, I use a variety of different artists. I try to always use Pete Barbuti, who is a very, very funny man, and if any of your listeners want to laugh for a while late at night when he can't go to sleep, go on to your internet and go to PeteBarbuti.com, and you'll see all these shows that he did with Johnny Carson and Merv Griffin. He's a very, very funny man. The important thing is that he's so funny, but yet so clean.
That's right. He actually got a start in Spokane.
That's right. He started in Spokane, yeah. He was born in somewhere in Pennsylvania, I think. I don't remember the town that Pete was born in. But he spent lots of time in Spokane, has a great base. But anyway, That's Italian started by one of our big theaters here in Palm Springs. In fact, the big theater in Palm Springs is the McCallum Theater. And I've worked there so many times and I have a great relationship with Mitch Gershenfeld, who is the entertainment director there. And after working there by myself with Steve Allen and the Desert Symphony, Mitch says to me, we get requests for Italian shows. He says, can you put together an Italian show? I said, you know, Mitch, I'm all Italian, my mom, my dad, my grandparents, but I don't sing any Italian songs. He says, you don't have to sing any Italian songs, just put a bunch of Italians together. So I got Julius LaRosa, Pete Barbuti, Dick Contino, probably one of the finest accordion players of all time, Vincent Falcone, or as we call him in this show, Vinny Falcone, and a big band. And we went in to the McCallum and did this show that was so well received that I began to shop it across the country. And we've worked all over. We've worked at performing arts centers in Florida and casinos in Atlantic City and Las Vegas. I had Jerry Vale as a part of the show for a while. Well, now Dina Martin has done quite a few of them with me. And Dina, who I met when she was just a young kid, actually, when I was doing Dean Martin's show, and the first summer show for Dean Martin was called the Dean Martin Summer Show, and it starred Lainey Kazan, Dom DeLuise, Rowan and Martin, and me. We did all 13 shows. So I had a great relationship with Dean, and when everybody left the Sands years ago, Sinatra went to Caesars, and Dean went to the Riviera, I followed Dean and went to the Riviera because I was doing all these shows with him. So I had a great association with Dina's father, and now she performs with me, and she does the same thing that Nat Cole's daughter, Natalie Cole.
Natalie Cole, yes.
Natalie Cole does this duets with her dad, you know, on a screen and whatever. Well, Dina Martin does the same thing with Dean. She has a screen brought down, and she and her dad sing songs together, and it's just so heartwarming. She just had a new album that came out this past year. We went to the opening party for it. It was at Capitol Records, and it was wonderful. They had the microphone that Dean used to sing in. They had her sing in that microphone that night, and it was a wonderful affair. And the name of her album is Volare.
I wonder where she got that idea.
I wonder where she did.
Hey, I'm going to ask you about the importance of arrangers after we listen to a song arranged, conducted, and the orchestra is Billy May.
I've never met you, yet never doubt, dear, I can't forget you. I've thought you out. I know your profile, and I know the way you kiss. Just the things I miss on a night like this. If dreams are made of imagination, I'm not afraid of my own creation. With all my heart is here for you to take. Why should I quake? I'm not awake. Isn't it romantic? Music in the night, a dream that can be heard. Isn't it romantic? Moving shadows ride the oldest magic word. I hear the breezes playing in the trees above. While all the world is saying you were meant for love, isn't it romantic? Merely being young on such a night as this, isn't it romantic? Every note that's sung is like a lover's kiss. Sweet symbols in the moonlight. Do you mean that I will fall in love perchance?
Well, you know, Frankie, you do such a great job on the ballads as well as the up-tempo songs like we
With
started
beautiful
the
arrangements like that written by Billy May. You almost just have to show up at the studio. It's wonderful to do those kind of things. And, of course, with a great song written by Richard Rodgers and lyrics by Lorenz Hart. And, of course, that song is one of the great American songbook. And, Tom, you know, I want to thank you and so many people who spin records around the world for keeping this music alive, this great American songbook. I just can't thank you and the other folks who play this music. I can't thank you enough.
Well, to me, it's the only really great music.
To me, it is. It was such a great era of music. You know, that song was written, God, I would guess somewhere in the 40s, and it's a beautiful, beautiful song. And when you talk about Rodgers and Hart and Cole Porter and all those wonderful, wonderful songwriters,
yeah.
And that great music. Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Well, and thank you for continuing to perform it live. I mean, you know, some of us were never able to, for instance, see Frank Sinatra live. Know his records, of course, but to continue to perform these wonderful shows and do this music live and with these big bands like you do, Frankie, all around the country, I think that's just fabulous.
Do it forever, Tom.
Good.
And forever in my lifetime, that is.
Arrangers were very important, or are important, aren't they? Musical arrangers, like Billy May.
They are. Billy May, Axel Stordahl, Nelson Riddle, Don Costa. Don Costa was, of course, one of Stephen Eady's favorite arrangers of all time, and he was so talented. But, the arrangers, they make you sound good. There's no doubt about it.
Well, Frankie Randall, thanks so much for joining us on Records with Reed, and we'll be co-hosting some shows, and we'll get the other stars from That's Italian on and have a little fun with them.
Terrific, Tom. I always enjoy doing your show. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Tom Reed and Frankie Randall on Records with Reed, and thanks for listening.